History. History is filled with long-standing grudges between cultures and nations. Some have many. In fact, one of the main protagonists of the story that I'm going to tell, the entity of England, which doesn't exist as an independent entity today, technically speaking, we say the United Kingdom now, and it is composed of England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, and which can boast many, many traditional enemies depending on the era in question. It can be argued that this was rightly earned, or with a history of aggressive colonialism and expansion. However, the UK isn't the only empire guilty of such behavior, as we've seen it countless times. We are most aware of the impact of England and the English, particularly here in the West, as it has become the language of majority in North America, and a sort of lingua franca in many other places in the world. A good example would be continental Europe. In some areas, we could say Scandinavia, places like Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, of course the Faroe Islands, and Iceland, all speak a language that is descended from Old Norse, with modern Icelandic being the closest to the original. Despite the similarities between these languages, with many words remaining the same, it is likely that when two people from different Scandinavian countries meet, unless bilingual, knowing the other's language, which is common enough, that instead they both settle to communicate in English. So let that sink in for a minute. The thought that despite the fact that their languages are both based on the same one, have probably a lot of the same words and expressions, some sentences are probably mutually intelligible, that it's easier for them to both speak English to each other. Because of this influence, it can be seen that England is the forcible oppressor. England is, of course, the oppressive arch-nemesis of the fledgling American Republic, the colonial oppressor of North and South America, Africa, Australia, and Oceania, and the religious enemy of Spain. Spain has a long history of being aggressively Catholic, and during the Elizabethan period, following the decree of Queen Elizabeth's father, Henry VIII, that the Church of England would split from the Catholic Church, put them at odds with Spain. But before all of that, the old enemy of the English was the French. Here in Canada, our official languages are English and French. And the public school reasoning being that our European colonial founders came from France and England. It completely omits the hundreds of indigenous languages and dialects that were spoken in this land for thousands of years, which until we as Canadians accept will mean the continued cultural genocide of its indigenous people. But for the purpose of this story, I will be focusing on French and English. I grew up in a small town in southern Manitoba, where the second largest population of French Canadians lives. The largest, the overwhelmingly biggest portion of French Canadians, of course, being in Quebec. Though a minority, Franco-Manitobans are fiercely proud of our heritage and of our language, and growing up, a lot of that pride was manifested in disdain for English. The school I went to, like many other French schools in the province, enforced a strict French-only rule. So that anytime you were talking in the hallway or there was any kind of dialogue at all, of course, outside of English class, had to be in French. History classes were taught with a narrative implying French culture was constantly being attacked by the big bad English. And of course, most Canadians are familiar with the Seven Years' War that saw the end of the contest over who would become the colonial power in Canada. And the French, of course, losing the decisive battle of the Plains of Abraham. Famously in that battle, the English commander James Wolfe was mortally wounded and lived just long enough to be informed that he'd won the battle. While his counterpart, the French commander General de Montcalm, would succumb to his wounds the following day, and of course the rest is history. This story goes back much, much further. The year is 1415. Friday, October the 25th, which was St. Crispin's Day, a Catholic saint's day. We are in northern France, about 40 kilometers south of the town of Calais. It is a miserable morning in late autumn, and in this place, on this day, there was a battle. The participants, being the army of the English, is led by King Henry Plantagenet V. The way I said that might throw you for a loop if you're not completely familiar with English history. It sounds like a French last name. And, of course, some of you might know already that for a very long time, following, of course, the Battle of Hastings in 1066, the nobility of England was for a very long time all ruling French, Norman French families. And of course, Henry V is descended from those Norman French of the House of Plantagenet, which of course was split into several cadet houses, his of course being the House of Lancaster. He was 29 years old at the time. The other participants, of course, defending their homeland was the army of the French, led not by the King of France, but instead by another man, Le Constable Charles d'Albret. His title meant, Le Constable, that he was the supreme commander of the French armed forces, answerable to no one other than the king himself. He was an experienced professional soldier in his late 40s. He had fought in several campaigns and had even gone on crusade. These two men were leading very different armies. They would fight very, very differently, and they would face off on a field flanked on both sides by light woodland. They would watch each other all night, an uncomfortable, rainy night. Then at dawn, they would take to the field in one of the most decisive battles of history, and in a battle that would show the high watermark for the English in the conflict that would later be known as the Hundred Years' War. Later kings of England, most notably King Henry VIII, would be jealous of Henry V's accomplishments, desiring for the glory and immortality the victory of this battle would afford him. William Shakespeare would write a play on this battle, made famous by the lines, "We few, we happy few." There's a little hint about the English army represented in that line. "We few, we happy few." The other line is the more famous one, which is, "Once more unto the breach, dear friends, once more." This line would later be used to rally English soldiers in every military venture it engaged in, from the Napoleonic Wars to World War II. It's a powerful piece of nationalist propaganda, but it's nevertheless stirring. "Once more unto the breach, dear friends, once more." This battle would change the face of Europe and begin the decline of the age of chivalry, also denoting the approaching end of the period we know as the medieval period. But there's some debate on that. I've found a few sources that I'll be mentioning throughout this podcast. However, the Wikipedia page on the subject, and I know quoting Wikipedia has maybe turned off some of the more ardent scholars that are potentially listening to this, but nevertheless, Wikipedia places the end of the medieval period at the conclusion of another conflict, one that would actually arise in England as an aftermath of the Hundred Years' War in France, with what was called the War of the Roses, a war of succession between the two cadet houses of the Royal House of Plantagenet that I had mentioned before. The houses in question were the Houses of Lancaster, as I had mentioned, and the House of York, which, fun fact, is the inspiration for George Martin's Song of Ice and Fire novels, more commonly referred to as Game of Thrones, or instead of the Northern House of York, we have the Northern House of Stark, and instead of the Southern House of Lancaster, we have, of course, the Lannisters. Anyways, I digress. Before any of these events could come about was this great battle between Henry V and Le Constable d'Albret in 1415. And that battle would take on the name of the small village it was fought just outside of. Its name is Agincourt, or in French, Azincourt. In my attempt to tell the story of the Battle of Agincourt, I will briefly discuss the events, as well as the geopolitical and also economic situation in the area during the lead-up to the battle, go into as much detail as possible on the battle itself, and then discuss some of the aftermath. I am a big fan of history podcasts, most notably being Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. Dan's storytelling is amazing. The delivery of his facts and anecdotes is incredibly compelling, and so I highly recommend anyone who hasn't listened to any of them to check those out. I will absolutely confess that he will have an influence on how I present the story, though I hope that I will be able to have my own flair and style shine through in a unique manner. I'll be releasing the podcast in episodes, just as soon as I've compiled a script based on my research. I will mention sources and where I found them and try my best to quote primary sources, a task not so easy when researching an event that took place nearly 600 years ago. But without further ado, I'm Eric Claussen, and this is the podcast about the Battle of Agincourt.